Welcome to Ask the Investigator, brought to you by the Journal of Drugs and Dermatology. The JDD podcast illuminates timely scientific content through thoughtful discussion with top dermatology authors. Subscribe to the Journal of Drugs and Dermatology at jddonline.com to browse the current issue and evidence-based peer-reviewed archives.
Welcome back to the latest episode of the JDD podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Adam Friedman, professor and chair of dermatology at the GW School of Medicine and Health Sciences. Today's guest almost feels like GW family. Dr. Nanette Silverberg is chief of pediatric dermatology for the Mount Sinai Health System and site director of pediatric and adolescent dermatology for the departments of dermatology at Mount Sinai West and Mount Sinai Beth Israel. Dr. Silverberg is a clinical professor of pediatrics and dermatology at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, and formerly clinical professor of dermatology at Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons. The focus of Dr. Silverberg's clinical work has been on the topic of pediatric skin disease. Dr. Silverberg has published over 200 articles, with more than a dozen articles and chapters on the topic of pediatric vitiligo. In fact, Dr. Silverberg was cited as one of the top 10 young vitiligo practitioners in the country at a recent plenary lecture on the topic of vitiligo at the American Academy of Dermatology. Today's episode will not be about vitiligo. Rather, we're going to switch gears and focus on an extremely disabling and disfiguring disease, acne keloidosis nuchae. And we'll be discussing with Dr. Silverberg her recent publication in the JDD titled Online Health Information for Acne Keloidosis Nuchae Has a Difficult Level of Readability. Welcome, Dr. Silverberg.
Thank you for having me.
So let's get into this interesting study. I guess first and foremost, how did you come up with this?
So actually, you know, I'm working with these wonderful med students and residents who have been networking through the year on skin of color and disparity-based studies in preparation for going into dermatology. And because there's so much focus now in the medical students who are coming through and amongst our residents, they have such wonderful desire to pursue social justice and disparity-based studies. And so they really wanted to do a study looking at readability of specific articles, in this case relating to acne keloidalis nuchae. And of course, we have to think about acne keloidalis from the perspective that it is a condition of African-American men, and this is a group that would be subject to heavy disparity.
And so when approaching as the literature, and I would argue that it's probably not a whole lot out there, though I think this is a condition that is extraordinarily deforming and disabling. How did you kind of go about evaluating the credibility or even the value or the readability of the limited information out there?
So there were six different scores used, including the Fleisch-Kincaid grade level score, Gunning-Fogg index, Coleman-Lau index, SMOG index, which stands for Simple Measure of Gobbledygook, which I love that name. I think I should use that every day. Index, every day. Automated readability, and the Lunsear-Wright formula. And each of these has a slightly different way that they assess the grade level and the readability of materials, and in combination, it provides a better overview of particular medical education literature, the study was conducted in a very special way. So first we had a Google search looking at for websites that spoke about acne keloidalis nuchae. There has been some published literature that supports that more than half of patients with keloids look for information on the internet. So It gave some support that acne keloidalis would be heavily reviewed on the internet by patients. So the total results, of course, resulted in 115,000 sites. And then running is, you know, kind of weeding our way through, looking for the sites that were more specific to acne keloidalis. And then those sites were specifically reviewed for readability. And what we found is really a very, very, the readability scores were very close, so that each of the rating scores demonstrates quite a bit of overlap. Some of the scores indicate even a little bit more disparity in terms of having high grade levels. You know, it's really important to have these grade levels, because we know that, you know, about when we look at the reading level of Medicare beneficiaries, we say that most of those, it's about the fifth grade for on average, and some studies will say sixth grade, so that we really want to have most of our published literature or online content to read at a fifth or sixth grade level and not higher. So we're really looking at a lot of content here that is reading far above that, and which is difficult for the average patient looking.
So I had never heard of any of these grading systems before. So it was certainly nice to learn something new. How did you even come across this? Or for those who now are obviously inspired by your enthusiasm for this type of work, how do you go about finding those types of tools and then, of course, utilizing them in a practical and efficient manner?
You know, we use six readability metrics. So there really are a variety of readability metrics, but you know, there are studies that look specifically at readability, and most of the studies pick multiple metrics just to help validate the information. So it's really common for these this group that was used to be used together. There can be some other scores that are used as well, but these were the ones that were chosen based on easy access to their to the scoring system and the ability of the participating writers and study participants to be able to access the scores to use, and many of these are available online.
So easily as accessible as the information that is hard to read, it sounds like.
Yes, and I think that's important. You know, I think that you can go, there are online sources for these, and I think that we can, I'm just going to put in, for example, you know, Google Simple Measure of Gobbledygook, and you can find from the NIH all this information they have on their websites, or you know, usually they feature some information on many of the research techniques, and you can find easily on PubMed comparisons of each of the different techniques, and you know, I'll cite you one particular study that looks at by Grabiel et al. From the Journal of the Medical Library Association. And they found a very high level of ease of usage when using these indices. So they found acceptable inter-rater reliability for the SMOG score in this particular study. And they particularly were able to use it as a specific method of assessment for addressing the AMA's recommended reading level of sixth grade. So, you know, they have not just been validated, but many of these scores have been specifically validated for that particular usage in reading at the sixth grade level.
So what's next? So you identify there's clearly a gap and an issue. How do we take this and make a difference and maybe improve things?
So I think one of the best features of the study is that these scores are fairly accessible. And what I'd like to say is for people posting information online, that it's really important to consider that if you are posting information that you think will be read by patients and isn't just accessible to physicians, that you should actually look at your scores before posting so that you can adjust the language accordingly. And I think that is something we're not used to doing. I think that, you know, it's sometimes we as an academic physician, one of the things that we really think about is, you know, creating this complex scientific language many times to express ourselves and what we've learned and what we know. And nobody else understands it other than us.
Right. Very true.
And that is true. It is true when you publish in you know, premier journals that you must express yourself in scientific terms. But you have to think about expressing yourself in a way that is readable when you are posting information online. So just thinking about who your audience is, accessing scoring to make this readable and particularly when you are focused on areas of disparity. And the particular article I cited you was on areas of Appalachia where there's a really low literacy level. So we have to think about, it's not just, they're all forms of disparity, and we have to acknowledge that all the patients who are going online will need to be addressed, not just people who are at the highest literacy level.
Right, and especially in today's day and age where posting and utilization of social media and websites to educate and get patients to get the help they need and deserve, this is needed now probably more than ever. So it's definitely something that's not in the limited, because certainly we don't have a lot of training on meaningful use or best practices as it comes to utilizing these pathways for disseminating information. That this should be, whatever's out there, this should certainly be part of it to ensure that your audience can actually understand what you're trying to get at them.
I agree.
Can't say anything more than that. Correct. Well, let's switch gears a little bit and talk about acne cutis nuchae, most specifically management strategies. And I think to start with respect to diagnosis, which I find more often than not, it's a clinical diagnosis that employs both the patient history, evolution, and clinical appearance. But as we know in dermatology, nothing follows the textbook, nothing follows the rules. What are some other things you might think about when a patient is presenting for the first time? And is there anything you want to make sure you don't miss?
So I think acne keloidalis is very often starting to present in young African-American males. It's often somebody, it's generally somebody with curled or coily hair who goes and gets a very short haircut. And for those of you in the universe who've taken your son for a haircut, when the barber sets the trimmer on anything less than a 2, so a 0 or a 1, that kind of haircut, that close shave creates pulls the hairs up and allows them to ingrow. So that ingrowth then becomes a nidus for inflammation. And so we'll see pustules and acneiform lesions, and hence the term acne. And in an individual who has the ability to form keloids, which is a large percentage of color individuals, that acne may trigger keloids, small keloids to form. And the chronicity is a particular issue because it occurs, it occurs again and again every time you go for a haircut, and it's often associated with things like pseudofolliculitis, Barbie, which gives you similar kinds of issues, and it's often seen in individuals who have careers that require close cropped haircuts, military, paramilitary individuals. And that's part of why some of our authors here were in the military Part of their focus is that it is very difficult for men of color in the military to maintain their hair well in the setting of acne, keloidalis, and pseudofolliculitis Barbie, because it is the career requires close haircuts and close shaving, but we have that for our policemen in New York City as well. And then you have the other issue of not tolerating that. So certainly, you know, it's a balance in life. And so I suggest a lot of things to our patients. We have a combination of treatment. The faster you can get in there, the better. You want to prevent keloid formation. And we've had people who had keloids that are, you know, 4 or 5 centimeters wide, sometimes 4 or 5 inches wide, you know, across the full back of the neck, where the whole area just had to be excised and left to heal by secondary intention. And that's the end stage and the most severe. On the other hand, a lot of opportunity is there to see these, young individuals who are, starting to trim their hair more closely and start to see these lesions forming. And to say to them, hey, you know, tell your barber 2 or more when they're trimming, perhaps in the back of the neck where you have these lesions, it's probably best that they hand trim with a scissor rather than with a trimmer or a razor, which will clearly trigger disease more readily. And, you know, treating the areas like we would, you know, when people get shaving bumps, we'll do antibacterials before but then hair styling happens. And when we do see new lesions like keloids, injecting them with intralesional Kenalog can be very helpful. Topical steroids can be helpful for very early lesions. And ultimately, being mindful of best practice. So one of the interesting things that I've read online or at the time that I was writing a chapter on acne keloidalis was that one of the contributors is not just hairstyling, but tight collars. And I often suggest to men who have acne keloidalis to think about wearing their collars a half size up. If you were a 16, go to a 16 and a half so you don't have as much rubbing. And also thinking about our youngest patients who are athletes and wear helmets, that can also be a contributor. So I often talk to people about having a little extra cushioning in that strip so that the friction is a little bit corrected. Some of our athletes who are playing football may wear a sweatband to help protect some of that area when playing sports. It certainly may help prevent some of the friction that occurs that can trigger lesions as well.
Also, those are two really important pearls that I don't think is commonly discussed. Absolutely. There's the two buckets. There's removing the offending agent, which is the clippers or the way the hair is styled. There's then using anti-inflammatory agents to quench the fire and limit further damage and perpetuation of keloid growth. But that was really interesting because, right, you have to consider the patient, what they're doing outside of your office that could also contribute beyond just the haircut. So I think that was so important. And I agree with you. I mean, I think, you know, time is of the essence here. The longer we wait to treat, it's great if we catch these patients early, but the longer we wait to treat, the more disfiguring this disease can be. And I use intralesional Kenalog in the office, high potency topical steroids, antimicrobials. I love to get your take on anti-inflammatory antibiotics, especially when you start to consider like sub-antimicrobial dosing of doxycycline, or now we have narrow spectrum sarecycline, both of which can be used longer than the current guidance of antimicrobial or antibiotic dosing of antibiotics. Do you employ these as well, especially more inflammatory disease?
So it's a really good question. And I do think that we I don't think every patient who walks through the door needs to be on them. But we just have some individuals who just seem to sprout up lesions frequently. Not always with any real inciting activity. You know, it's just doesn't seem, you know, they're not getting haircuts every minute of the day. And yet new lesions are forming. And I do think that at some point the follicles do scar a bit. And that you can start to see some, because of the change in follicular shape, you may be more prone to blockage and acneiform lesions. And of course, these are products that are approved for acne. So chronic acne can occur on the neck as well. And to treat the acne, as particularly people who get very severe keloids rapidly, it is important to control the acne component and to prevent that from triggering scarring. And we have that as well for men who have, there are men who have keloids on the face from acne, and those individuals need to be treated quickly. So I do agree with you. There is a role for oral antibiotics and for more extended sub-antimicrobial type antibiotics or more extended usage of products that for prevention. I don't think it's an answer forever, but while we're trying to get control of the disease, if the disease activity of the acne is preventing us from getting control of the scarring, we need to really think about that stricter control as we would for any form of acne.
Do you find a role for whether it be topical or even systemic retinoids? I mean, certainly in pseudophilicus barbae, I find employing maybe one of the, I guess, quote unquote, milder retinoids to kind of, you know, soften the perifollicular skin, prevent follicular hyperkeratosis, that may contribute to limiting that kind of curling in, though we have to balance the irritation of a retinoid with their benefits. Have you found any utility for them in the management of this condition?
So, you know, I think that there is a body of evidence to suggest that all acne treatment is potentially helpful for acne keloidalis nuke. And it'll vary what we offer in terms to our patients in terms of care in that area. So sometimes I'll offer something that's a combination of a benzoyl peroxide with a topical antibiotic. Sometimes we'll do, a combination with a topical retinoid. I think that there's a really old paper going back into the 80s looking at, they called it in that paper, folliculitis nuke sclerodicans, which is probably really like an acne keloidalis nuke, treated with isotretinoin orally. And I think that it may be the case that at the point that we have more even topical isotretinoin could be interesting in this particular condition. But all the retinoids may have some benefit in terms of acne prevention in this particular situation. And I think all the acne therapies are particularly maybe beneficial, but particularly I do agree with you, things that prevent formation of lesions may be particularly helpful. And I do have some patients for prevention on, it's very hard to use. I like benzoyl peroxide and acne keloidalis nuke, but it bleaches collars. And so it's a little bit hard to use for long-term prevention. I often use it as a wash in the shower and have people dry with a white towel versus you can use a topical retinoid. And that is very reasonable in these situations for prevention without necessarily staining a collar. And so I think cosmetically speaking, they can add into your regimen quite nicely.
Yeah, that orange stain from BP certainly is not a good look. And I imagine there are plenty of favorite shirts, towels, and sheets that have been laid waste, unfortunately, to that. So rest in peace.
Just as a Q-tip, I just want you to know there's a Q-tip. There are colored towels, you know, colorful towels They're benzoyl peroxide resistant that are sold for dorm rooms. So just something to think
about.
Yes.
You heard it first here. That's news to me. That could certainly save a lot of cloth. Well, thank you for sharing that. And of course, thank you so much for sharing your expertise for this wonderful work, highlighting the need for us to be conscientious that whatever information we want to get out there, it's of the utmost importance that those we are trying to reach actually understand what we're putting down. So thank you for your contributions.
Thank you so much. I much appreciate your speaking with me and for your thinking about this topic.
Yep. And thanks all you for tuning in. Stay tuned for the next episode of the JDD Podcast.
You've been listening to JDD Podcast, Ask the Investigator, the number one podcast for dermatology pearls. Our host is Dr. Adam Friedman. The podcast is produced and edited by Emily Lynch Fries. Our theme music is Designed for Life by Young Presidents. New episodes are available the first Friday of every month. Check us out at jddonline.com/podcast or wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you want to talk to us about this or any other episode, email us at info@jddonline.com. Subscribe and review the podcast on iTunes or Google Play, and don't forget to catch our next episode. Thanks for listening.